You're listening to episode number 2 of The Optimal You. In this episode, I talk with film and TV star Eddie Cahill about motivation and drive, having empathy for ourselves, how to handle fear, his approach to auditions, life's process, and much more. I'm men's coach Andy Bates, and it's my mission to raise the consciousness of other men so that they may be better to themselves in relationship as leaders and fathers. In each podcast episode, we discuss strategy, learn from real-life examples, and get practical tips on how to be the optimal you. Eddie Cahill is an actor who's been in the movie Miracle as goalie Jim Craig, on Friends as the character Tag Jones, and for 9 years he was Detective Don Fleck on CSI New York. His most recent role was as District Attorney Connor Wallace on the ABC series Conviction. I sat down with Eddie at his house in Los Angeles for a very casual and wide-ranging conversation about his early childhood, how he got into acting, and then into more practical things about what to do with fear and how the understanding that life is a process brings him a sense of satisfaction. Just so you know, on the technical side of things, during our talk there was a break and the conversation topic changed when we got into it again. I covered this transition with a pretty awesome sound effect, and you'll notice that. Also, I'm recording on location and the sound is not spectacular. And lastly, just so you know, there are expletives used throughout the interview. And without further ado, I give you my conversation with Eddie Cahill.
Hey, man.
Hey, man. Thanks for coming over.
It's good to be here. I've never been into this house before.
Yeah.
You like LA?
I do. Been here since May 16th of 2002. It took me a little while to adjust to it. Somewhere around the 10-year mark, I think I realized that I liked it. And then I've kind of been falling in love with it ever since. Yeah, I think it's a great place.
Because you're a New Yorker.
I'm a New Yorker, yeah.
Yeah. Born and raised?
Born and raised.
In the city?
Born in the Bronx and then raised in the first half of my life in Yonkers. I did my high schooling in a town called Pleasantville, and then we moved into Manhattan when I graduated high school. Okay. We moved around quite a bit, so yeah.
Creative household?
No.
No? No,
not at all. Not at all. Not intentionally creative, you know what I mean? But no. No, not a creative. I would not at all.
You're the only person in the arts?
I am. Yeah, I'm in the middle of two sisters, and I'm the only one who pursued a life in the arts.
When did the acting start?
I decided that I wanted to be an actor when I was 16. We went to see Les Mis. I thought about this the other day. For those who don't know, there's a character in Les Mis called Eponine. Over the course of that production, realized that if I could save Eponine, then I would have accomplished something in my life. So I got into acting to save Eponine.
what happened? What's the character of Eponine?
She's an orphan, and she is the story of unrequited love, in that she has fallen for somebody who is far outside her class. It's like Cinderella, in a sense, and I wanted to get my hands on her and lift her up.
What was it?
I think I just like underdogs. I think I've always felt like an underdog. I think I relate to the underdog. She would be something to fight for, you know what I mean, in a way.
So something inspired you about...
Something inspired me, I think, about falling in love in live performance. I just think, as an audience member, to experience that rush of feeling toward a character, toward a myth, really, but in the person of this woman on stage. And it was the first time that I was ever overwhelmed by that in story, in performance, in any of it. And probably was the most profound. You know, I don't know that it's been topped since, you know, and part of that, I think, had to do with my youth, you know, being 16 at the time, and just at the, I don't know where you are in puberty at that time, but, you know, there was hormones raging, there was, you know, all those feelings I get driven that way to, you know what I mean, mm-hmm. and anger and savior complexes, and, you know, I wanted to fight, and she seemed like something to fight for.
Was the acting, like, why not something else that has a heroic...
Well, I mean, I've also, you know, I also, you know, the something like police officer, something that always spoke to me, you know, when I was a kid, and that was something that I kept in my mind. I don't know that, you know, and stayed with me actually for some time, stayed with me until I reached an age which was 35 years old, where I would no longer qualify for the New York City police test. You know, and my grandfather was a city cop. And I just always admired that profession for some reason. As I got older, I realized it didn't fit for me, you know, and I think even 10, 15 years into my career as an actor, I still had a hard time accepting myself as an actor, or still trying to find the kind of sense of purpose that I thought, you know, rescuing Eponine would provide. So yeah, there's been other fantasies as well. Teacher is another one. I like the classroom, I think. And that's something I still haven't ruled out. I could see myself in a classroom again as a student and or as a teacher.
You see Les Mis, that's what I want to do. I want to be on that stage. Where do you go from there?
I went to my high school theater program, and I was a sophomore at the time. And that's where I went and got myself a non-singing role in The Fiddler on the Roof. And that's where it started for me, you know, and I went to high school that had a strong program and support for the theater, and that's where it began for me.
You saw Les Mis, you got inspired, then you started actually acting on the stage.
Yeah.
Was the love instantaneous?
Well, yeah, I mean, but love, yes. The love was instantaneous, but, you know, love is not necessary. It's challenging. You know what I mean? It was. That was probably the first time I had a sense of myself as somebody who could actualize himself. You know, that was like the first time I made a decision about something I wanted to do that potentially had a future beyond, you know, what was scheduled that week. And I don't mean even a professional. It didn't like come with professional aspirations. And I never really looked to the industry as something. I never aspired to the industry. It was just in that theater, in love, I want to do that. I just want to do that. That's what I want to do. Mm-hmm. And started doing that.
Do you think you were driven as a kid just in a lot of things?
No. I think that was the beginning of it for me. Because I didn't have a lot of confidence as a kid. I didn't think I was very smart. I didn't think I was... When I was a young kid, up until 8th grade, I was a very heavy kid. I wasn't driven in the classic sense of the word, in the like, you know, I was a good student or I was out to please people. But I was driven by something. But I started smoking cigarettes at 12 years old and got involved in some other things that weren't necessarily like... positive, I would say, but I was driven. Yeah, no, I was driven by something. Mm-hmm. You know, I had fuel. I just didn't, and I think getting involved in the theater was the first time I could take all that energy and start to put it into something that felt like that was positive, for lack of a better word.
So the drive could have been just that you don't want to have these negative feelings anymore. I don't want to feel.
Yeah.
Awkward.
Sure. Yeah. I guess so. Yeah. Right. Yeah, I wanted to feel like I was worth something, you know, and I think that, yeah.
And the stage was able to give you that.
Yeah. Yeah, it's funny, I've never really thought about it, but yes, yeah, I think so.
After high school, did you go to college to study?
I did. I went to, for 2.5 years, I went to college, and the last year and a half of that, I spent at New York University studying with the Atlantic Theater Company through the Tisch School of the Arts. So I did that.
Were you getting a lot of great feedback with what you were doing? Like, you know, how are you keeping going? Or is it just
I was a student. You know, I was a student. And so I got feedback that students get. But how'd I keep going? I liked it. I liked being in the studio. I liked doing the work. It was confusing. And I think, like, well beyond my years. Actually, 2 nights ago, I went, my neighbor here is the head acting teacher at the MFA program down at USC. And they had a showcase, and I went to see it, and it was a fun way to kind of go back in time. For all of them, they had this compass in the form of practiced and studied, you know, techniques of sorts that they will grow into. You know, sometimes I regret leaving that experience early.
So why did yours stop?
It was too expensive. I say it's too expensive. And it was. And I probably could have found other ways to make it work. you know, but there might have been other reasons at the time that I just wanted out into the real world.
And so you leave school, but then you keep pursuing.
Yes, acting. I left school. It's a cool story. I left school and I was studying at the Atlantic Theater Company, and they allowed me to sort of, I worked at the school when I left school. I worked at the school in their rehearsal space, answering the phones, you know, scheduling rehearsal studios for various productions that would either use the space or students who were using the space, a little bit of cleaning, you know, at night, lock the joint up. And then they also had a theater that I was the house manager at. So whatever their show was, you know, I would show up there and kind of, you know, make sure the front of the house was acceptable, you know, be out there for the run of the show. If who knows? I mean, I don't know what I would have done, but I had a mag light, you know what I mean? Exactly. It's theater. Anything could happen. So I was there. I was working at the school, and it was sweet of them. They kind of kept me around in that way. And then there was a class of students who were a year ahead of me who were doing Craig Lucas's Blue Window as their third year production, and they were short one guy. And they cleared it with the university, and they asked me if I would do it. So I jumped in and did that play, and I got an agent out of that play.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Yeah. It's pretty cool.
That is cool.
Yeah. Because I'll tell you what, when I was in school, I didn't fuck around. Like, I at that point, I was driven. Uh-huh. Like, okay, so once I found, like, I think, was I driven before? No. But I think once I got into this thing, then I was like, and it was on. And I had a couple moments, you know, a year or two where I shied away from it because it's scary. I was scared and I backed away. But then by the time we're talking about now, I was driven. When I got to NYU and I got in the theater program, if there was a production going on, I was working on it. I was doing props. I was stage managing. I was just everywhere I could be to keep myself in the thing. Maybe that's why subconsciously they kind of kept me around.
In that world of the Atlantic Theater, were you still battling the feelings of awkwardness? Because like you said,
those haven't gone away. Oh, yeah. I mean, I battle to this day. I mean, they don't go away. That's actually been one of the more stunning revelations as I've gotten on, is that never goes away. It's how you respond to those feelings that kind of, you know, informs your ability to make moves or not. And I've had, you know, I've had success in quotes, you know, or I've managed to, I shouldn't say even success, like I've survived and lived through versions of not being kind to myself about it, and kind of still, you know, in spite of that, hustling through it. But I would say about 9-10 years ago, the notion of empathy entered my purview by way of, you know, sitting down and talking with a therapist and using talk therapy to you know, try to get at my feelings, figure out where they were coming from. And in the last, you know, decade or so, I've managed to cultivate some empathy and compassion for myself, which has been helpful in dealing with those feelings, because they don't go away. One of my drivers now is not punishing myself for having conflicting feelings. So say if I'm scared at an audition, and this is something like, it's not like I've arrived at a point where like, oh yeah, now I accept all my fear and I'm fine. But I've learned very recently, actually, an experience I just had where, like, if I embraced the fear and offered it an ear and listened to it and allowed it to exist simultaneously with my ambition, then it didn't define the entire experience. If I tried to fight the fears and I mean violently fight them and kind of punish myself for them, then they just took over. You know, fear, I'm a big boxing fan. I've been a big boxing fan for a long time. And one of my last experiences, it just clicked to me. I was like, you know, all these guys that I look up to, they're scared. In spite of that, they have to relax to a certain point where they can perform. So it got me thinking that somewhere along the line, they're embracing this fear and can deal simultaneously with it. In my experience, part of that is accepting it as a normal part of, and I think that's a challenge we all have. And sometimes I think this is a product of us being thoroughly embedded in a culture that thrives and lives on advertising, which has a very polarizing images that they sell. You know, mm-hmm. get a BMW, you're happy. It's mm-hmm. like, well, fucking mm-hmm. maybe not.
Right.
You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Or you're happy for 8 minutes and mm-hmm. then you drive it off and you get a scratch on it and suddenly you're not happy. Mm-hmm. You know, and you're stressful. Mm-hmm. It's stressed because you're driving a $50,000 automobile around. It's just to say that, like, they're all, it's all in all the time.
What you're saying essentially is that fear is a common emotion. Everybody's
yeah.
going to feel it. You're going to feel it all the time. But when
yeah.
you're allowing it to make the decisions for you is when it becomes problematic.
Address it as a friend instead of address it as an enemy combatant. Like, if you start to fight your fear, ultimately what's going to happen, in my experience, is you're going to wind up beating yourself up. It's just, it takes so much energy to fight with fear that's not going anywhere that you just wind up depleted and mm-hmm. less than optimum. Case in point, I had a audition for a pilot recently, and I went in my first audition, and I have an audition uniform that's like, you know, it's a black t-shirt essentially, the pants swap out, but it's just whatever. I figure it's basic, it's simple, it doesn't say anything, you just go in there and you do it. So
yeah.
I don't wear a lot of suits in my life, and I get a callback for this particular audition, and they're told, all right, we want to see Eddie in the suit for this one, and I have mm-hmm. one suit, and suddenly all the fear that I was feeling over the thing attached itself to the fact that, like, my suit's not good enough. That's where it starts going.
Mm-hmm.
My suit's not good enough. I don't have the right suit. Everybody else has nicer suits than I have. They're all going to be dressed properly, and I'm going to look like some asshole in his father's clothes. And
you're,
I was
obsessing,
like,
over your fear.
Yeah. It's not even that I was obsessing over it. It's just what it latched onto, and it became the focus for a moment until I put the suit on, called my wife and said, can you take a look at this for me? And got and asked for help. Until I asked for help with that fear, I acknowledged it. Said, okay, this is where it's going. This is what it's attaching to. Take a look. Suit's fine. Great. That's done. And immediately the fear jumped onto something else. You know what I mean? It's like, so then I had to address that.
Okay.
And it's just a matter of being in conversation with it. And you know, and it got to the point where it's like, it doesn't go away to the point that when I finally show up for my screen test for this thing, I'm signing contracts. I had so much adrenaline, so much energy in my body that I had really no command of my left hand, which is what I used to write. I couldn't write my name. You know what I mean? So my signature looked nothing like my signature. It's like I was just coursing with all of this, but somehow over the 2 or 3 days I had to prepare for this and in making the choice to just engage every moment of these fears and be like, you know, and address, it didn't derail me. Mm-hmm. I wasn't thrown by the fact that I was scared.
Mm-hmm.
I wasn't thrown off by the fact that, you know, I had no command of the motor skills in my left hand because I had been engaged in conversation with these feelings, you know, by way of my journal, by way of asking my wife to look at the suit, by way of talking mm-hmm. to my 6-year-old son and telling mm-hmm. him on the morning of the screen test, I'm scared.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like you felt when you... I feel like you felt when you had to sing at the holiday show at school
mm-hmm.
and you got up on stage and just kind of letting it be, you
embracing
know,
it.
Embracing it. Because to go back to the advertising thing, it's like fear's not bad. It's inevitable. You know, and I think when we start to qualify our feelings as good feelings or bad feelings
mm-hmm.
and this idea that like happiness is somehow a good feeling and fear
mm-hmm.
is a bad feeling, well, it's not. And we run into a lot of trouble when we start to qualify feelings that
mm-hmm.
way because we think we should be something else. Well, shouldn't I be happy because happy's good and fear is bad or sad is bad or mad, you know, whatever it is, just take it. It's coming because you're never getting away from it.
Right.
You have moments, you know, but we move in my feeling, I feel like, you know, it's like we cycle. So it's like you get happiness sometimes for a little bit
mm-hmm.
and sometimes you don't. And then you
mm-hmm.
get sadness and it depends on what's going on.
So do you think there's any choice in the feelings? Like, can you choose to be happy?
Not necessarily, no.
Okay.
But I don't think so.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm open to, you know, changing my mind about that. But I think you choose how you see it. I think you choose how you deal with it. I think chasing feelings is problematic. The only people I know who chase feelings, you know, systematically are drug addicts. I think accepting feelings as they come feels to me a more of a long-term investment way of going about an emotional life. Role of Sex and City comes up. I go in and audition for it. I shit the bed at the audition because I couldn't. The problem with battling my fears the way I did and have and probably will at times, and it got in the way of what I needed to do to prepare so that I could exist simultaneously with the fear.
Mm-hmm.
So this would be a classic situation where you got a young kid who's terrified,
mm-hmm.
gets a good opportunity, goes in, and just, you know, can't really get my point across at that time because it just, you know, I would shell up. However, at the time, I'm involved in this play, so I'm working as well. the night after opening night, I come into the theater and there's a post-it note on the little area where I get dressed, and it says Sarah Jessica Parker, and there's a cell phone number. I was like, get the fuck out of here. What is this? What is this? So someone in the office tells me, yeah, she wants you to call her. I was like, all right. So I called her up. She says, hey, I saw you in the play last night, and we're trying to cast this role on Sex and the City. Do you want to come in and read with me? And I said, of course. I'm terrified, but yes, of course. And it was for that same role that I had just read for. So I went in, and now it's her. And it's
so you went in for the casting director?
I went in for the casting director.
And blew it.
And blew it.
But she's seen the play.
She's seen the play, calls me up. You know, I think unbeknownst to her that I had gone. Because I can't imagine my, you know, tape made it anywhere.
Right.
So I go back in.
And she's in the room.
She's in the room, and it's all the producers and everyone. And now I'm like, I thought I was scared before, and now I'm really scared. Uh-huh. I shit the bed again.
Okay.
I just can't. I didn't have the skin on me to at the time to kind of get through that.
Yeah.
You know, because that was in my mind, that was big.
Yeah.
You know, and it was. So I didn't impress at the audition, and then she bought tickets for the producers to come and see me in the play that night. And they came
really
and saw me in the play.
You.
She believed in me. And that means a lot. You can't go in that room wanting something from those people. You have to go in with something to offer. Mm. And then I think once I kind of internalized that notion, then it became, what do I need to do to get the fuck out of my own way so that when I'm in there, I am offering them something? And nowhere as an actor does that work. You don't step on stage wanting the audience to like you, even though we do, and we want to be accepted all the time. But if you're performing in such a way that is like, you know, please like me, it's just not compelling to watch. Mm-hmm. And you're not giving the gift of nobody's going to want to save you.
Well, that's practical advice that I think anybody could apply to, you know, anything, mm-hmm. a job interview.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's essentially, an audition is a job interview.
Job interview.
Right. And so going into a job interview, not thinking, I hope they give me this job, I really want this job.
Yeah.
But
what
can I bring to this job? What's the offer?
Yeah.
How am I going to add value to this place?
And if you're struggling with confidence, and if you're struggling with a sense of self or self-worth, it's like, it's hard to get to that point.
Now, how do you do it? What do you do?
Acceptance. You know, for me recently, it's I mean, for a long time, what I do is you just grin and bear it. You sometimes suffer through it.
The typical actor is auditioning all the time. And
yeah, if he's lucky.
If he's lucky. And he's getting rejected all the time.
Yes. Yeah.
How do you deal with that? How do you deal with the rejection?
It depends. You know, there's sometimes where I've gone in the room and been like, yeah, I get it. I wouldn't have taken me either. I didn't show up. Sometimes I think, like, you know, in this last experience I had where I did wind up getting the job, I think if I didn't, it would have been hard to take, because I worked so fucking hard to try to figure out how to give of myself and get out of my own way. It would have been hard, you know what I mean? Because I wanted it. But how do you do it? It's just par for the course. It happens. You know, I've been fortunate and I've been privileged in my career in that I've always had opportunities. So the more I was hearing no, the more chances I was given. And I've just managed to look at it that way. Every time I heard no, that was an opportunity. A lot of my friends, a lot of my brothers and sisters in the acting community don't get the opportunity. I think that's helped me. You know what I mean?
The opportunity is that you've gained more knowledge, that you can grow from the experience.
I think so. Because I never, it's like I didn't get, I, you know, it's like when I was young, it wasn't like, you know, there were times when I'd have 3, 4, 5, 6 auditions a week. You know what I mean? That's a lot of opportunity.
So you have an overall feeling of gratitude towards just the opportunity.
Yes.
That keeps a fire going, I guess, that you don't want to take it for granted.
I don't want to take it for granted, no. Because I have worked hard to get these opportunities. Mm-hmm. They're precious. And as I get older, they get even more precious because the opportunities are fewer now. There's far more opportunities for, you know, a 22 to 27 year old, you know, white guy who's 6'2" than there are for one kicking the ass of 40. There's better roles for guys at my age. I'm excited that I've been around long enough to start to step into some man roles. The guys who are around, you know, get better and better, you know, and I don't want to be playing freshman ball when I'm a senior. Like, statistically, I haven't succeeded as much as I've quote unquote failed, but by trying to bring something to the table that offers people a glimpse at humanity that maybe they can relate to, or maybe it makes them laugh, or maybe, you know, but showing my appreciation that way by trying to, like, have something to offer.
I like that. So is acting where you find the most satisfaction in life?
I love being on set. I love being a part of the carnival, I call it. I feel like a circus performer, you know. I don't know if it's where I find the most satisfaction, but there's a unique satisfaction that that I get that's specific to playing make-believe with, you know, a team of people who are similarly invested, which probably can be boiled down to just I like being on a team. In fact, I like communicating with people and collaborating with people and working with people. I'm pretty satisfied. You know, it's like I like to wake up and just be a person in the world is pretty satisfying to me. And I managed to carve out a life where my professional life plays well into that and satisfies it. My home life plays well into that and satisfies it. I have good friends that I enjoy spending time with. I think I'm most satisfied when I am, like when I'm in the fight. I find somehow the courage to say, okay, I'm scared, or I feel like I'm not good enough, so I'm going to take a class and I'm going to jump in and I'm going to put myself in a position where I don't know, because I realize that I'm scared to not know, and it might have taken me 10 years to fucking get into it, but I'm going to do it. 32 years old, be like, I've always wanted to play the guitar, and I see a guitar guy playing guitar and he's really good, and I ask him if he teaches, you know, and 8 years later I play the guitar. When I feel like I'm in pursuit of understanding both of the world around me and the world inside of me, that's when I'm most satisfied, when I get these little moments of understanding. And 20 years ago, I think I probably thought, God, there's so much to learn, I'm so fucking dumb. And now I'm like, oh my God, there's so much to learn, I want to live forever.
Right. I just love, I think, that there's been that sort of common thread for you, that you've had a thirst for growth and experience, and even though you had some self-defeating mm-hmm. tendencies, mm-hmm. that, you know, desire for learning continued to thrive, and now you actually have changed your whole mental attitude, mindset around mm-hmm. it.
Yeah, it is cool.
And do you think there's any way for someone that doesn't have the experience to come to these same conclusions, or is it just, these are just things that we learn as we grow and mature?
You know, I think, like I was talking to a group of students at NYU a couple weeks ago. I was in New York, and I have a friend who teaches at the Atlantic Theater Company. I've mm-hmm. maintained a little bit of a relationship with them. And whenever I'm in town, I like to sneak in and just sit down and watch. And this class was actually there was a class where I could come and kind of speak with them the whole time and, you know, ask them questions, and they asked me questions. But I said, I was like, you know, if you could pinpoint where you need help and just kind of put it out there and find the courage within yourself to say, I want to do this, I'm scared, I need help, I know, you know, or whatever it is, mm-hmm. I need $15, can someone help me, or, mm-hmm. you know.
Yeah, don't be afraid to ask.
Yeah, don't be afraid to ask for help, you know what I mean?
Even if it makes you feel vulnerable.
That's it, especially if it makes you feel vulnerable. Like, it's okay to feel vulnerable, and I didn't know that.
Some people won't judge you for that, right? Mm-hmm. It actually will help you.
Yeah, right. The people you need mm-hmm. won't judge you for that. Like, where help exists is in that place. And that's part of the challenge too. It's like, you know, we sit here, we talk, and it's like life is so much more complicated than, you know, kind of boiling it down to these sentiments. And I've been able to kind of boil them down and relate them to my 38 years on this earth. All you need is the little nugget to go off on. I think I can, I think I can, I think I can, I think yeah. I can. It doesn't mean, you know, okay, just fucking start there. You yeah. know what I mean? See where it goes.
Boils down to one thing. If you have a desire, do it. Just jump in.
Yeah, do it. Participate.
Yeah. Thinking about it.
Doesn't do anything.
Obsessing about it.
Yeah, doesn't do anything.
Right.
Put it into action. Participate in something. One thing that I'll tell you what I find. Here, you want to know what satisfies me? Process. Process satisfies me. I have learned to derive pleasure out of process. And that, I think, has helped me deal with the idea of results in such a way that I'm okay. You know what I'm saying? Like, some people are like, well, if I do this, I do this, I get this. I get this if I do this. Well, but if you do that, you also get to do that. Doesn't matter what you get. You may not know what you're getting. You know what I mean? You might actually lose something, mm-hmm. or you might gain something, or who knows? Or you might get something you didn't even fucking see coming. But if you're engaged in the process in such a way that process fulfills you and fulfills you, and I simply think that it's just, you know, like I was saying to my wife the other day, it's like, it's all practice. It's all fucking practice. We practice, we practice, we practice, we die. That's it. You're not getting anywhere. Yeah, you'll reach these things that feel measurable at times, whether it's financial, whether it's, you know, in your love life, what, regardless of what it is, it'll feel measurable. It doesn't absolve us or remove us from the process. Process is what we have. Results are kind of these things that happen as a result of process, but you usually can't predict, you know?
Yeah, if you're thinking, if I can just achieve this, everything will be fine, I'll be happy.
Right.
There'll be no more work to do at that point. That's a myth.
Never happens.
Yeah.
Not in my experience of life. I think one of the benefits and one of the challenges of me choosing a freelance life in the arts has been, for better or for worse, I am dealing with sudden and rapid change. You have a job, you don't have a job. Mm-hmm. You're home one day, you're gone the next day. You know, and these things as I get older are disruptive as I, you know, now have a family and live mostly in one place. You know, I get a phone call one Friday night at 5:30, says scan your passport, you're getting on a plane, you're going away for a month tomorrow. And then this could then turn into a job that takes you away from the place you're living for 9 months out of the year.
Yeah.
You know, and talking to my wife about it, I said, you know, babe, I think the more we can accept the fact that like sudden and rapid change is a part of our lives in a way that may be more frequent than others, is the easier it'll be for us to deal with it. Because, and I'm fortunate in that my job will do that to me. A lot of people's won't. Mm-hmm. So I think for those, it's harder to deal with that kind of stuff. But that's sort of a fact of life. You know, you see, and you don't know what it is. It could come in the form of an earthquake. Mm-hmm. It could come in the form of falling in love. Mm-hmm. It could come in the form of a sudden death. It could come in the form of, you know, it's like, I think, I love using my body. I've grown to appreciate my body and what it can do. I like walking. I like exercising. I like doing this with friends. I like doing this alone. Well, what happens if I'm paralyzed? I also like using my mind. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? And I also like using my arm. So just trying to make sure that, I don't know, it's an investment in, it just goes back to curiosity.
Mindset of adaptability. And acceptance.
Acceptance.
Yeah. Yeah. This is what's happening.
Yeah.
You know, I'm going to make a choice to be a part of it or not be a part of it.
Yeah. And maybe I'll get through, and maybe I'll be able to do that for the rest of my life, and maybe I won't.
Have you established any routines that add stability to your life, like a daily routine?
Yeah. Lately, something I've been trying to do is I try to read a little bit every day and or write a little bit every day. I exercise, you know, spend time with my kid, my wife.
Do you have a specific morning routine?
No. You know, sometimes my morning routine is get up and journal. I have routines depending on what's going on in my life that are very, like if I'm working, it's like I'm usually up very early and I'm writing because I'm charged with something and I'm working through stuff, you know, and it's just journal entries, you know, whatever, what's holding me back or whatever the questions I'm answering are, or this, you know, happened last night or whatever. This is how I'm feeling. And then I always like to do my exercise before anything happens. So I'll do whatever exercises I'm doing. But right now my routine feels kind of loose.
Can you talk to me a little bit about body image?
Sure. Yeah.
I mean, you said you were a heavy kid.
Yeah.
When did that change? And cause now
I changed in eighth grade. For me, I suffered under the illusion that there was a such thing as a perfect body as far as visually speaking, and I then realized that I'm probably never gonna have that because it's largely based on perception. Then I started and I think as a result of that, like, you know, I started working out young because in pursuit of this kind of idea, and I also use my body for work, so I've been trying to figure out how to make this thing expressive at the same time. And but in some of my more, you know, misunderstood approaches to it, like my workouts became punishing and I was hurting myself in trying to like perfect this thing that I just kept, you know, beating up on. And as I've gotten older and some of the piss and vinegar has fallen out, you know, and I've slowed down a little bit, it's become more playful for me. Like my physical activity has become more curious and more playful and less this like rigid thing that's in pursuit of a, you know, a narrow vision or just, as far as body image goes.
Do you feel a pressure from you know, just the job?
I do. I do. And I have to manage that because I always feel, the way I feel is I always feel like I should be more something than I am. But I also realize that my, you know, tits and my abs at whatever level they are not the most interesting thing about me. And if I choose to pursue them in such a way that they become the most interesting thing about me, then I think my work will suffer. So right. I spend a good amount of time. I combine my physical exercise with mental exercise too.
That's interesting. It's back to your suit analogy, yeah. Right? If right. you're just obsessing over the suit.
I don't look good. Exactly
you're not
right.
offering the full Eddie experience.
That's exactly right. That's exactly right. And it's funny because I recognize that I'm not one of them naked dudes, you know what I mean? Even though, you know, but more so than I was when I was a kid. Jesus, when I was a kid, poor bastard, like, you know, I was in New York in June, I would wear fucking sweaters and long clothes. You know, I was just trying to hide it all the time. Mm-hmm. So, and with that, I think, you know, started to embody feelings of shame about it. And, you know, and I've had to deal with that, mm-hmm. you know, and I still deal with that.
Do you have any practical tips on how somebody can really define what their true value is?
Meaning
that they're not looking at their physical appearance as what the value they bring to the world is, but more that I look this way, but this isn't what I can bring to a relationship, to my job.
I mean, maybe it comes down to value systems at that point, looking into who you surround yourself with, what kind of image about you they reflect back to you, what your relationships demand of you, what they, you know, for good or for bad. Because I know you're not going to find it in one place. You know what I mean? Like, you're not going to go to the gym and solve all your problems, and you're not going to, you probably have a better chance at the library, you know, and I can't really speak from too much experience in that regard, but I don't know. I mean, that's a heavy question, but it's a multi-pronged approach. For me, it comes back to recognizing where you feel inadequate, finding out where you need assistance, where you, and start asking. I don't know, actually, how to answer that question. That's a huge question.
Mm-hmm. I'm curious. Yeah, that, I'm wondering. The business you're in, it's all about how you look.
I mean, it can be, you know. Mm-hmm. I mean, and look and appearance is certainly, but how you look is so informed by what fills your body, not what your body looks like. How you look to people is the energy, is your soul. It's like, I met a lot of fucking pretty boring fucking people out there. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Because they're hiding. So, you know, get yourself out of hiding if you can. Mm-hmm. You know, and don't put in effort to hide behind something.
I think that's common experience everybody can relate to.
Yeah.
I know I've been in ruts where, yeah, I can recognize, oh, I'm hiding.
Hiding. Absolutely.
Hiding from life, hiding from something. And,
right.
And it really takes that recognition of that to where you can say, I just need to do something.
Do something.
I gotta get the ball rolling again.
And you don't have to do it alone. Actually, you do have to do it alone. You can do it alone with other people, but ultimately it comes down to you.
Right.
And patience is a virtue. You create a life that feeds the thing. You know, so it's like a 6-week plan is a 6-week plan. If you can sustain that 6-week plan for the rest of your life and it works for you, great. But you got to find a way to make the process work for you. And every day is a process.
What's your diet like?
Fairly simple. And I run into situations where I can get into some emotional, you know, binge eating if I want to get down with some sugar and shit. You know, and I'll get down with some sugar. But clean. I eat clean. I don't snack a lot, you know. And if I do, it's, you know, fruits, nuts.
Mm-hmm.
I'm working on getting more vegetables and more of like a color spectrum in my mm-hmm. in my thing. But I like to go out to restaurants and throw down, and you know, I like to drink and mm-hmm. do all that fun stuff.
Is it something that you think about a lot, or just?
Oh yeah, think about it all the time.
Okay.
Yeah, because you got to make a plan. I got to make a plan for it every day to some degree. And I live in an area where there's, you know, there's so much kind of good eating around and support for, you know, a quote unquote healthy lifestyle. I'm like, you're smiling. What do you got?
We just went to a lot of things that were unexpected.
Nice. Yeah. Well, that's the fun really part good. About chatting.
I just want to express my gratitude for you.
Thank you.
Taking the time to open up, be vulnerable with me.
Yeah, I appreciate it.
Like, we talked about a lot of things that may be challenging.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah, yeah. No, I mean, this is a first for me. I don't usually share like this in this format. So, yeah, no. So I appreciate having trust with you, you know, and the relationship we have. And it's been, you know, a little scary, you know, but thank you. Thanks for saying that.
But I'm very appreciative. Thank you.
Cheers.
So can you tell me who's been the most influential person in your life?
My dad.
Tell me more.
Well, he's my male model. You know, he's what I had to look to. He's the guy who I've wanted to be and wanted to be nothing like all at the same time. And we're close in some ways. We don't share a lot of intimacy, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. But we're close. I just realized that as I work through my challenges, you know, in life, good and bad, or good and scary, a lot of it comes back to my, you know, relationship with him as it relates to me and myself and, you know, trying to carve my own path and, you know, honor him at the same time and also be something totally different and new. Because it's the hardest relationship I have. It's the most conflicted relationship I have. So I think it's been the most, what was the question? The most
influential.
Yeah, I think he's been the most influential. I come up against him more than anybody.
How does he influence your parenting? Or does it?
Yeah, you know, it totally does. Our kids are improvements upon us. And I think that's probably hard as a parent. And I know, it's like my kid was fucking with me the other day, trying to pull a fast one on me. I said, listen to me, you're going to be smarter than me one day. Mm-hmm. It ain't going to happen at six. But you'll get there. It might be 11. You know what I mean? But it ain't going to happen at six. But I think that, you know, in recognizing that, it's like I come up against, you know, my son pushes my limitation. You know, my limitations in some respects come back to my father. My experience of what a father was versus what I want to project to my son of what a father is.
All right. Cool, man.
All right, man.
You got anything else?
Good luck. Good luck. No, thank you. This has been fun. I appreciate it. It's always nice to hear myself talk. With a friend in the room.
All right, man.
All right.
If you like this podcast, please subscribe. There are many more great ones on the way. And if you're ready to tap into your own potential and be the optimal you, contact me today by going to theoptimalyou.com.